place at that point, then that reformer, which has different names according to the tradition that mentions this, will arrive and will usher in a new era.
Absolutely, and so also something that we've been talking off camera about as well. Sayyid Ammar, if I can come to you, Sunnis and Shia Muslims both agree that at the end of times there will be a figure by the name of Imam al-Mahdi who will emerge and will bring peace on earth. Who is Imam Mahdi exactly?
Well, as you say, I mean, Sunni and Shia, of course, both agree that there will be this messianic figure from the lineage of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, and his family, who will appear on earth before the day of judgment. And just building on what the esteemed Sheikh was mentioning, that, of course, he will fill the world with justice. There's also a consensus that Nabi Isa, Prophet Jesus, peace and blessings be upon him, will pray behind Imam al-Mahdi. There are some, you know, smaller theological differences there about the role of the Imam and who he is. But broadly, this is where the consensus lies between the two schools of thought. But there is essentially this idea that the Mahdi will have divine authority. He will fight against the oppressors and will extinguish their oppression. So he is a figure who will essentially be the culmination of justice, and that sort of divine justice that we as human beings can't hope to achieve by ourselves. But there is a misconception. There is an idea that we should just be passively waiting for Imam al-Mahdi to arrive. Actually, you know, the understanding that we should have is that we should have an active waiting for our Imam, because we prepare for his arrival. We try to better our condition as much as we can, and so that when he arrives, we are prepared to work with him as our leader to establish justice across the whole world.
Yeah, absolutely. A debate that's long been ongoing between Muslims as well, as to whether we should just be sitting passively or whether we should be actively engaging in preparation for the Imam, which I guess, Sheikh Hanif, leads me to my next question, because there are many who may point to the fact that Imam al-Mahdi is not specifically mentioned in the Quran. Does he really exist? And does the Quran maybe allude to his coming or to his presence?
Yes, the Quran, there are many, many, many verses in the Holy Quran that allude to this, his presence. And I think it is an allusion because it is not essential a belief to be a Muslim, right? You can be a Muslim and not believe in the Imam, you know. Personally, I think it might make you a little weaker, you know, but, you know, it is there. You know, for example, you know, I think in Surah 25, verse 5 or 4 or 5, you know, it talks about, you know, those who have been abased in the earth, you know, Allah would make them imams, you know. And it talks about, in another verse, that those who do righteousness and so on, Allah would make them successors in the earth, you know. And these things tend to allude to the idea of the Imam being such a figure, you know. The Imam Mahdi is from these verses basically one of a group, one of a class of people. You know, the only difference is that he comes at the end of time of this cycle of humanity, you know, and that at the end of that particular cycle, you have this this reign of justice that is taking place and truth, you know. Nevertheless, there's always a worm in the apple, you know, because eventually he himself is going to get martyred, you know, and then, you know, the descent of human beings will continue downwards until the day of judgment. So he becomes a very, very important sign for the coming of the day of judgment.
Absolutely, and an important sign, and also somebody who is giving a lot of hope to humanity as well. And that's something that Ayan Islam did. We went to the streets of London to ask Muslims about the significance of a Messiah in terms of giving hope to their lives on a personal level and with events happening on a global level.
Imam Mahdi is the divine promise by Allah for the uprise of good over evil and to eradicate all oppression in the world.
I think that Imam Mahdi is important because obviously he's a religious figure to all of the Muslims, whether you're Sunni or Shia, it doesn't really matter. And I think that, you know, as my sister said, he's someone that's going to bring the world justice and someone very important because I feel like the world is very corrupt at the moment. Like, we need someone to come and lead us together as like an ummah.
To me, Imam al-Mahdi is the saviour that we're waiting for. We all want to serve the Ahlul Bayt, but we were not there in Karbala. We all wish that if we were there, we would have served in Karbala to serve the Ahlul Bayt, but we weren't. Now, inshallah, if Imam al-Mahdi comes, we can serve the Ahlul Bayt through Imam al-Mahdi.
We need to the Imam al-Mahdi for he when he come, inshallah, he gonna regal everything and the Palestine he come in the to us again.
So Imam Mahdi symbolizes justice. Obviously, as we know, he's supposed to be bringing justice to all people. So with the current situation that's going on with Gaza and other parts of the world, for us to have him come now would be the step forward that we need to to start making change.
Now, Sayyid Ammar, if I could come back to you. Earlier in the show, you discussed, of course, those who say, you know, we should be actively preparing for the Imam's return. Others saying, you know, we should just wait and be quietist, if you will. There are many who look at the Prophet and the past Imams and the narrations about Imam al-Mahdi. They say that he will be socially active. You know, he'll be like an activist as well. What will the world look like in the event of Imam al-Mahdi emerging on earth?
Well, it's building on something that Sheikh Hanif was mentioning earlier in the program, that the world is going to be in quite a bad state. You know, at the end of the day, we have to remember that the appearance of our Imam, and may Allah hasten his appearance, is a sign that the, you know, the Day of Judgment is very, very near. And of course, the Day of Judgment is going to appear in circumstances when the world is in, you know, a very, very bad state. And of course, you know, when I was talking about the idea that we should be active, we have to look at all of the prophets in history, all of the imams, all of our righteous leaders, even our, you know, best known ulama. They were people who were active in their communities. They were people who took a stand against oppression, who enjoined the good and forbade the evil. And we have to remember that, you know, at least in Shi'i theology, the imam is already on earth. He is present with us. He sees the injustice that is happening, for example, in Gaza. He sees all of this that's happening around the world. And so, you know, he is already with us in our struggles. So when we are looking at these struggles and our imam is there, but he is an occultation, the responsibility on us should be thinking, what can we be doing to work for the appearance of our imam? It's not that we're just waiting for him, and because we have to then think, if our imam came tomorrow and questioned us, you know, what have you been doing while I have been in occultation? What have you been doing while, you know, you've had the opportunity to at least say something verbally, if not, you know, literally take action? What is our response going to be? You know, we have to be thinking that the arrival of our imam is imminent and working towards that. And so we have to be constantly in the back of our minds thinking, what more can we be doing actively? Because our imam sees everything that we're doing.
Well, that is interesting you say that, because of course with Palestine on everyone's minds at the moment, attention has turned for many people to whether we are approaching the end times. What's the relevance, just staying with you, Ammar, of Palestine in these end times?
Well, you know, in Abrahamic eschatology being that part of theology that deals with the end times, you know, the land of Palestine is very, very important. It's very important for Jews, for Christians, for Muslims, such that, you know, we have these fanatical Christian Zionists, millions of them around the world. They're probably more Christian Zionists than there are Jewish Zionists, who want to see the destruction of Beit al-Muqaddis, Masjid al-Aqsa, and the creation of the Third Temple of Solomon as a prerequisite for the return of Jesus, for the second coming of Jesus. Now, we have a number of, you know, narrations ourselves about the land of Palestine, not just Al-Quds, but of Gaza, of Asqalan, different parts of what we now call Palestine. And we believe that Imam al-Mahdi will actually go to those lands, that there'll be ships sent to those lands if he is not physically going there himself, to, you know, bring justice to that part of the world. So the land of Palestine is very, very important for all three Abrahamic religions. And, you know, certainly in Islam, we do believe that Jerusalem and the lands of Palestine will feature very heavily in the Imam's mission for justice.
Thank you, Sayyid Ammar. Sheikh Hanif, one of the things that's always interested me is that argument about do we sit by passively or do we actively move forward as Muslims to try to prepare for the coming of Imam al-Mahdi, which could be in any era. Muslims for thousands of years, or a thousand years at least, have had this thought. One of the things that interests me as well is post-revolution in 1979 in Iran is the constitution actually of the Islamic Republic of Iran says that this state is actually belongs to Imam al-Mahdi. It's fundamentally a gift, a hadiyah. And this was one of the driving forces behind Imam Khomeini's revolution, which is that fundamentally, at the end of everything, what we are doing is a gift, a hadiyah, a preparation for Imam al-Mahdi. How important is that? What should believers be doing in anticipation of the coming of the Imam?
Yeah. It's a very, very interesting and a very great idea, conversation, right? I mean, just to get more extreme, you know, there are some people who think that they welcome injustice, they welcome oppression, because that means it will hasten the coming of the Imam.
Yeah.
So not only are they not doing anything, okay, they are positively encouraging it, yeah. You know. But I think, you know, this type of attitude goes against reason,
yeah.
Okay? In the sense that when we look at oppression, to a certain extent, oppression is based upon an agreement between the oppressor and the oppressed. In the sense that if the oppressed doesn't do anything, the oppressed is agreeing with the oppressor that they should be oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's like somebody in a society who says, I'm not going to vote. Okay, not voting actually is a political statement, is a kind of a vote,
you see.
You know, there's a very beautiful hadith by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, where he's talking about the people of Shu'aib, you know, and it's a town where it's, let's say, I think about 100,000 inhabitants, and Allah is going to destroy this town, which had... 40,000 of those people were evil and 60,000 of them were good. And Allah says, I'm going to destroy the whole town. And Hazrat Shu'aib asks him, well, why are you going to destroy the whole town? The majority of the people are good. He says, because the majority of people did not stop the minority of people. You see? So that attitude is an un-Mahdi-like attitude. The second point is in terms of fellowship, following the Imam. There are two types of followers. You know, there's one follower who does not take initiative, right? And another one follower who is just waiting to get the order. They carry the order, then they sit and they wait for another one. And there's another follower who is a sort of a reflection of the leader, right? A follower who could take initiative, a follower who could anticipate, you know, what the leader wants and so forth. This is the kind of leadership the Imam wants. This is the kind of leadership that will be following the Imam. And the final point is, we have to ask the question, why is he in occultation? You know, from a Shia point of view, or why he's not yet born, sent to this world from a Sunni point of view, you know? And the usual reason is because the Muslims themselves are not going to support him. You see? And so he's not coming until that point is reached where they reach a certain desperation, you know, of course, assuming that they're the ones who are struggling, you know, for him to come. So I think it is very important for many of our masajid and so forth to let us know that we need to sort of be Mahdis in a certain limited sense in order to prepare the way for his coming. The other thing about what should be done, I think, you know, I mean, it goes back to the very beautiful hadith by the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi, where he says when a Muslim is confronted with wrongdoing, they should change it with their hands. If they can't do that, then they should speak about it with their tongues. And if they can't do this, hate it in their heart. And hating in the heart is the sign of the least iman that you would have, or the least sign of iman. You know, direct action, okay, could mean, for example, Muslims trying to seek political power or social power in the environment in which they are in. Mm-hmm. So that would maximize their ability to make an effort. Among our communities, for example, what we should be thinking about is, let's say, settling into different parts of the city as a majority, the parts of the societies mm-hmm. that we live in as a majority, especially in the West, mm-hmm. you know, where we could have an influence upon the voting process and that type of thing. For example, in Birmingham, you know, you can't easily get away with RSE types of programs.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because, you know, Muslims control the Board of Education, et cetera, et cetera. This is what we need. Mm. You know, we find that Muslims are always spread all over the place. It minimizes our effect,
yeah.
you know? You know, things like this. With respect to Gaza, it's very important how Gaza opens up, you know, to us the lying of the society, of the governments that we are in, the fact that they are bribed, that they are actually being paid off, you know, that is an undermining of democracy and things like this. You know what I mean? So I think these are a lot of challenges that we have to pose to the system, to the environment, you know, to be able to bring that type of empowerment for us.
Yeah, and I think one thing that maybe is key in these types of times is things that have run their course, if you will. I think we're getting to a point where people are losing faith in democracy.
Right.
They understand that maybe in the Western model, democracy doesn't actually exist because both parties, if you have a two-party system, are controlled by the same kind of banking influences in the background. So maybe all of these things need to run their course until humanity gets to the point where they realize, okay, we need a divine intervention now. And that's what we need to be preparing for. Sheikh, I would love to have this conversation with you for a lot longer. Unfortunately, we are out of time. And likewise, Sayyid Ammar Kazmi as well. Thank you for joining us with your fantastic contributions. I'd like to also thank you at home. You can join us again next week for another edition of Ayan Islam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة. The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge with Sheikh Mukhtar on IRIB English Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of a guide for managers based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently focusing on the 53rd letter, which is a letter that Imam Ali alayhi salam wrote to Malik Ashtar, giving him certain guidelines with regards to management and leadership. And Imam Ali alayhi salam beautifully explains very many important points that are necessary for a leader to keep in mind, especially with regards to certain people that he places in sensitive positions. So a leader, for example, has got some ministries or some institutes where he keeps certain leaders for those sensitive positions. He has a certain duty with regards to those people. One of them is that Imam Ali alayhi salam says that he should carefully supervise them actively, and even to the level of keeping spies, so that those spies can give him information with regards to the performance that he is performing in his affairs and in his duties.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَبْعَثِ الْعُيُونَ, that allocate some spies that are going to follow up the tasks of this person. Now, this is something very, very important, because this particular person that you have chosen in this position, he has a very, very sensitive position. His decisions are going to affect thousands of lives. Hundreds of thousands of lives sometimes. Sometimes even millions of lives. So, it's not just one person now. This is the destiny of several hundreds of thousands of people. So, this being the case, you need to be very careful and it should be airtight. And the person also knows, who is in that sensitive position, knows that there are people around him that will spy, that are going to give information with regards to his work. And in fact, he should be happy about it. He shouldn't feel sad, because that will also encourage him to do the right thing. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَبَعَثِ الْعُيُونَ مِنْ أَهْلِ الصِّدْقِ وَالْوَفَاءِ عَلَيْهِمْ, that you should allocate some spies for these workers of yours, for these people that are in sensitive position, for these middle-level leaders. Put some spies, and these spies, min ahli sidqi wal wafa'i alayhim, they should be people of truthfulness and people who are trustworthy. They should be truthful and trustworthy. When you keep such people, then you will see the work will be done well. In fact, the person himself who is in that sensitive position will feel at peace, because he knows that if I get stuck in my duties, I know someone is going to remind me. I know that there are going to be some people who are going to send this information to the higher level authorities and I'll be questioned. So he knows that I'm going to deliver. For a person who enters such a position and knows that he's supposed to deliver, he should in fact be happy that there are people following up. He should in fact be happy that there are some spies that are going to supervise him, because he will be on track. But if a person is not serious about leadership, is not serious about doing work, he doesn't want to get work done, he will feel bad about these spies. He'll say, why are people spying me? They don't trust me? No, they trust you. They like you. In fact, they want you to do your duties, and that's why they're keeping these spies. Because you as a human being can sometimes forget, can become oblivious, and you can lose track. In fact, these are going to keep you on track. It's a very wonderful thing, inshallah, if the governments are to keep these statements in action. You can see a marvelous change in the way managing happens. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin
wa ali Muhammad. Sayyid Razi, also known as Sharif Razi, a religious scholar and theologian, holds a significant place in Islamic history for his invaluable contribution to the compilation of Imam Ali's profound teachings and speeches, which were later compiled into the influential literary work known as Nahjul Balagha.
Now, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that the higher level authorities need to keep spies or need to have active supervision, even secretive active supervision with regards to the lower level authorities. And in fact, all levels of authority should have some level of, you can say, some kind of follow-up and supervision so that things go well. So he says, فَإِنَّ تَعَاهُدَكَ فِي السِّرِّ لِأُمُورِهِمْ هَدْوَةٌ لَهُمْ. He's saying that your concern, your, for example, follow-up and supervision in secrecy, لِأُمُورِهِمْ, for their works and their tasks, هَدْوَةٌ لَهُمْ, is a kind of encouragement for them, is a kind of incentive for them. It is a motivation for them. Why? Why is it a motivation? Ala, he says, hadwatul lahum ala isti'amali al-amanati wal-rifqi wal-ra'iyati. He's saying that this will become a motivation for them to use those budget, the budget, and you use the entrusted amount of money that they have in the right position. That's why it's hadwatun. It'll give them a motivation that I need to do the right thing. And then he says, وَرِفْقِ بِالرَّعِيَّةِ, and at the same time, they will also be careful and deal well with those people that are under him, the civilians and the citizens. They will be treated well by this person because he's being looked after, he's being taken, he's been looked over, and he's being followed up in that sense. So in general, what will happen is that this person will be able to do his duties well. And I think many of the countries, the way I'm aware of, is that many have this kind of system of looking and spying in a positive way. Although sometimes, unfortunately, it is used in a negative form to encourage some negative policies. That is wrong. But if it is used to encourage policies that are positive, that are good, that are beneficial for people, then this should be something that can be taken seriously and applied. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar in the program Gate of Knowledge on RIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers. In Islamic upbringing,
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids? That is, from the very beginning of the birth.
I have a little son, and he is so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and youth, guided by the wisdom of the Holy Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, who is a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed some light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
So, we've been discussing a certain question in the past episodes, which was about what to expect from your teenage son and how to, you know, ensure proper training from a young age. And you gave us some very nice tips, and inshallah the listeners can go through them in the while listening to the previous episodes. And we reached on, avoiding idle talk, that it's very important to instill this characteristic that, you know, when you're seated together as a family, or when you're talking to your child, or when you're talking even to your spouse, the children are watching you, they're hearing you, you know, you have to make sure you don't just talk useless things all the time. They have to know that there is some sort of substance in your
yes,
speech.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So, by idle talk, even I mean any kind of idle amusement, lahw and la'ib, it's introduced in the Holy Quran.
Yeah.
That you should stay away from those kind of things, that wastage of time, that don't give you any benefit in the long run. So, you know what? The impact is a negative one. You get a negative impact. Your mind becomes tired. Your soul does not accept that. So a child, teenager becomes then cranky and very angry, frustrated, depressed, all this anxiety, you know, when he over talks or over does something, even overplays a game. You'll see, even if it's a refreshing game like soccer, when he plays it too much, he gets very tired. And okay, that's a good sign if he gets tired, but then he won't like it even, you know, in the end, that he when he overdoes something.
True.
So in the Holy Quran, we have in chapter 31, ayat number 6, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "And of the people is he who buys the amusement of speech to mislead others from the way of Allah without knowledge, and who takes it in ridicule, those will have a humiliating punishment." Why? Yeah. Allah is harsh in that. A humiliating punishment. That means Allah knows that this has such a negative impact on your soul. Because Allah doesn't want to punish only. He is Rahman and Rahim. He knows that you yourself will have laid out this for yourself. Such a, you know, like a anxiety will overwhelm you that you won't even feel like, you know, doing other things
just
properly.
Feel depressed. And this is exactly what the Western like propaganda is, that they want to kind of make you just waste time on watching thousands of movies or thousands of serials, which
or
are,
Instagram, for example,
or, yeah, or pictures Instagram. Or
whatever, wherever you go, wherever you land, whatever food you have.
Yeah, sometimes it's so easy to just go on scrolling Instagram for even hours, and then you suddenly feel like I could have done so much more.
Yes.
So many
and it doesn't
things.
Even give you that peace in the long run. Yeah, so that's what is lahw and la'ib. So any game even played with that I want to improve my concentration is not lahw and la'ib. But anything even like for example, done for amusement, like going to the park, which seems like, you know, like playing a game or something. If it's done for refreshing yourself, giving yourself this time, it's not lahw and la'ib. But yet, if you, for example, you don't know why you're reading this book or watching this movie, you keep on and on doing it, and you're wasting your time. That's exactly what lahw and la'ib, or keeping on talking on the phone hours on end, you know, getting every detail. What's the use? Or to your spouse, details for what? It's all lahw and la'ib, I feel, you know.
So I think it's like,
there's so much intelligent conversation that can go on between spouses.
Definitely.
You know, about people, what's going on in the world, what, you know, like we can do about it, or the program, that the planning of their life ahead.
Very true. I think it's very important to like keep that balance. Yeah, very true.
Yeah.
So we're just going to have a short break and we will continue shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about a very important characteristic to instill in our children, and that was avoiding idle talk and wasting time as a whole, like overdoing amusing things. Well, like you said, that there's ifrat and tafrit, you know?
Yeah.
Excessiveness or
negligence.
Yeah. So keeping that balance sometimes is difficult.
Yeah.
So you've been saying that the child becomes depressed and anxious and angry when they are, you know, they don't have anything to do, or they are doing something excessively which is not of benefit.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
So if the parents should set an example in such a way that the child should learn, there are certain quiet moments that they should have together. For example, like reading or watching some important program or news or something like that. And then they should discuss over the dinner table, is something a time of bonding.
Yeah.
That the purpose should be achieved of bonding. We should ask the daily activities, what went, what happened, have the light humor, reassure them that they are loved.
Yeah.
You know, they're supported. Ask them of how their day went, what needs they have, for example, what they require probably in some area, like, you know, for example, while growing up, you need so many things like clothes and stationery and things like that. So you can find them that out about them. All that has a purpose, see? But when you become purposeless, you talk about different things, fantasies, games, clothes, shop, materialism, what people are doing, and backbiting and fault finding,
yeah.
All this.
No substance.
Yeah, no substance in it. So all that arises, those kind of negative thoughts, negative emotions, and the repercussions are not good. The teenager will also become like that, will talk to his friends subconsciously because he has got this lesson, like the same way as the parents talk, although he wouldn't, let out.
Yeah.
He wouldn't even show it, but he will talk the same way to his friends. And he wouldn't get that, that peace of mind, that peace of soul, that's so important.
Definitely.
So if the parent wants to raise a teenager like that, they should start even with talking substance, the way you say.
Yeah. So, do you have any other points regarding this?
Yeah, no, not this subtopic, but I have another point of how to raise the teenager in such a way that they're expected to become pious leaders, inshallah, for society.
So, before you continue, we're just going to take a quick break and we'll continue shortly.
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "A righteous child is indeed a flower from the flowers of paradise."
Ya muqiy al-khayrat, ya muqiy al-khayrat.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing a very important characteristic that we have to try and instill in our children, which was avoiding idle talk and wasting time. So, Sister Salma, you said you have another important point that you want to talk about. Please enlighten us.
Yeah. Another thing that the parents should be very careful about, and that even should be instilled in from a young age, so that the teenager doesn't find problems facing that aspect, is don't be attracted to worldly things.
Mm.
You know, the world is very limited, it's very, fleeting, and it shows, the wrong thing. And we get attracted to it, and only to find out that it wasn't that pleasurable that it seemed. When we attain it, then the interest goes away. We want more. It's like that ocean that, the thirst that keeps on, and it's drinking salty water, and the thirst never gets quenched. Okay, we know all these things, but how to inculcate that in the child? When a child wants something attractive, first of all, don't encourage him. If he needs it, buy it for him, but don't keep on buying those things for him. And make sure the way you dress him, feed him, all should not be like something that is so show-offy, like something that calls for attention, or for him to have a mark type of clothes or the best kind of food. We should be so simple in our lifestyle that the child doesn't entertain this kind of even, you know, worldly materialism in his mind.
Yeah.
For example, some unfortunately, I know of some people who, teenagers who are so much into clothes and they can't wear apart from marked clothes, clothes with mark. They just can't wear, even if it be such a simple thing, but they can't wear. Who said the shoes even, they can't wear something like, you know, if they're not marked shoes,
yeah,
the shoes of mark. So all these things are actually
branded, you mean,
yeah, brand. All these things start at home. The parent buys the best kind of clothes. They want the children to dress the best way possible, thinking that they have the best, so why not give the best? Okay, there is a planning of Allah to give this wealth to a person so that they can also save and share also. And not, you know, like make the child be so, you know,
like make this seem as something so important.
So important and so like something that has to be that only. For example, some children can't do without having a certain kind of breakfast. They have to have a certain things in their table so that they can have breakfast or lunch or dinner. They can't eat certain foods. They can never eat simple foods. They have to have the best kind of things.
And regarding clothes, I remember there was a certain family who would only make their children wear branded clothes. So when we wanted to give them gifts, they nicely told us that, look, you won't get the clothes that we get. So,
and that's so
just
embarrassing,
give us,
isn't it?
Just give us the money
it's
for it.
It's too embarrassing, yeah. For both the parties, it's embarrassing. So, like, even if, for example, even when you want to give such people, you think about it, it'll go waste, right?
Yeah.
So, what do you do? Like, this is the way that Allah loves, you know, تَخَفَفُ تَلْحَقُ. Lighten yourself and soar high.
Be humble.
Yeah. And also, that qana'at, you know, that
contentment.
That contentment is so important that there's a hadith of Imam Ali that the richest is the one who is most content. And it's such a beautiful feeling to raise the children like that, yeah? Whatever you have, be content. Even if it's a simple bread or like a date, you know, we have at least what we want is that satisfaction and that energy we get from it, yeah?
And in fact, when you see the people today who are, for example, very well off and you see them very, you know, oh, they're wearing very like simple clothing and all, that's kind of more attractive because you feel like, oh, they know what they have is like what is important is something else, not the zahir and the world.
So this is what the parents should inculcate. What is important is that other side of you that is the soul. Not that body. The body is fleeting. And the body requires some needs that we make it like the goals. We don't make it as the means.
Very
you know?
True, yeah.
We give so much importance to such kind of worldly things that it becomes the goal rather than the means. So all this is of course shown right from the beginning of training a child that how simple you are, the child will become that only. And this is a very important ayat in the Holy Quran. Allah mentions in Surah 31, ayat number 33, chapter 31, ayat number 33. O mankind, fear your Lord and fear a day when no father will avail his son, nor with the son will a son avail his father at all. Indeed, the promise of Allah is truth. So let not the worldly life delude you.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the worldly life is a delusion. You know, once it's over, even in like an old age, one doesn't attain that pleasure of anything, even food, clothes, nothing. So from a young age, if they inculcated this kind of behavior, that use, kulu, washrabu, wala tashrifu, yeah, but don't do israf, don't go extravagance, you know. So all this is beautiful when child realizes that anywhere he can adjust, he can be content. But such people who have high expectations and they're so worldly, they can't adjust, but they have to have the best, you know, like an environment to live in. And if they, for example, fall in the hands of some other families, like for example, if they get married and they see other kinds of situations, they won't just, you know, like resist.
They
won't be able to continue and they will lose their form and, you know, their personality.
Very true. So, inshallah that, you know, we are all able to be such strong
simple people,
and simple
people,
inshallah. Thank you very much, Sister Salma, and inshallah we hope to hear from you in the next episode. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran. for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the 1981 hunger strikes and the legacy of the 10 men who died. How did this seismic event change the direction of the conflict, and what have we come to understand about its impact for generations to come? My next guest is a former hunger striker who spent an incredible 70 days without food. He joined the strike on the 29th of June 1981 after Bobby Sands and three other IRA prisoners had already died in H Block prison. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gillernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh, South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Lawrence McKeown. He is a former IRA prisoner, author and screenwriter. After serving a life sentence in prison, Dr. Lawrence McKeown obtained a PhD in sociology at Queen's University Belfast. He's also co-founder of the Belfast Film Festival in the mid-1990s. Lawrence McKeown, welcome to the show.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Michelle.
So, Lawrence, tell us a bit about your childhood growing up.
Well, I grew up outside Rondlestown, which is about 20 miles from here. Very mixed area, religion-wise, and in a often hasten to add that I never see the conflict. Here is about religion, it's been about politics, but religion has been used as the empire has used, you know, tribal difference or skin colour or whatever else. So it's a very idyllic sort of upbringing. I've written about it that when I was 10, I learned to drive a tractor on a farm that was next to us, Davy Warwick's farm. Lovely neighbours, wonderful people. Went to a very small local school, Farn Fluch, which I was delighted about years later to discover it was actually from the original Irish, which was like wet townland, but at the time this anglicised version just seemed a bit absurd, you know. I ended up getting my 11 plus and moved from this really two classroom school to St Malachy's, the largest grammar school, and I hated it with a passion, and I think that's where my sense of rebellion started, because I began to Mitch school, so I travelled to it and hang out down around Smithfield, or I'd never been to Belfast before, but I just hated the school. I think it was this moving from this very informal, localised, rural sort of setting to now this, you know, you're studying Latin, and if you go to the gym, you have to have, you know, different shoes for different, you know, purposes and all the rest of it. So yeah, I blame that on my later activities. But very interesting that I was growing up through that period of the civil rights, and unbeknown to me at the time that certain things were unfolding that had had an implication for my own family, because I mean, the whole civil rights movement was about an end to discrimination in housing and employment, as you know, Michelle. And I think, but for me, the biggest impact was the activities of the Ulster Adventure Regiment, which was a locally recruited militia the largest regiment in the British Army, and over 90% Protestant. And there were people from Randallstown who I would have known and played football with when we went down. Down that time, we used to walk down the town of Crowdivis. That was all you had in those days. And being stopped with them, and I remember the first night, I don't remember the guy's name at all, and him asking me, what's your name and where are you coming from, where are you going to? And he was embarrassed because he was beating me, saying to me, what's your name? Mm-hmm. But the second, third time it happened, the embarrassment had gone, and it was the arrogance. And been stopped and just been held, and none of us were involved in any politics or anything at that time. But it was a big influence on me, and I think it was at that point, certainly by the time I came to 16, realising that there are two communities, but it's not about what church you go to on a Sunday. It's about that one has the uniforms and the weapons, legally, and the other doesn't. It has, you know, its IRA, and at that point I was 16, I decided that I wanted to become part of what was happening, and to become part of was to join the IRA, which I did whenever I was 17 years of age.
You were on that 1981 hunger strike, Lawrence. You're a walking miracle. You went 70 days without food. Tell us more about that.
Well, in the 1981 hunger strike, initially there was only four people ever going to be on it. That began with Bobby and Frank and Patsy and Rimmon. And then one of them died that they would be replaced. So there was only ever going to be four on it at one time. But in June, it was decided to increase the numbers on it to eight. So each Monday, someone new joined it. Not because someone had died, but because we were bringing up the numbers. So I joined which was the last one out of that four to join on the 29th of June. By that time, four people had already died. I mean, a full set of people, you can only understand the hunger strike in the context of that 5 years before it, where it's a total, okay, you understand the big political issue, the criminalisation, attempts to criminalise the struggle, and so on and so forth, but it also becomes personalised with just even the prison guards, the screws at the door, you know. And it's not like, oh, well, you've got a range of choices, A, B, C, D, which one we go for. It was either you walk out with hands up and capitulate and become yes or no, sort of three bags full, sir, or it's hunger strike. And in that context, I suppose the biggest thing for me when I began it was a week later the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace came in. So I was taken up to the hospital along with Beck. I was in the same wing with Beck. And Mickey Devine was brought from H5. So it was an opportunity to see all of the people there. People were still alive. And important lesson also that day that everybody was brought in who was hunger strike. The only one missing was Joe McDonald. And if I hadn't known that, I wouldn't have recognised the person that came through the door who was in a wheelchair. Joe was always nicknamed Fat Joe. He always had been able to retain a bit more fat than the rest of us. And that's, which is odd, most people were undernourished. Like, I was 10.5 stone when I began the hunger strike. I mean, about 13.5 now or something, when I'm not carrying massive excesses, because everybody was malnourished after a long time. But Joe was brought in, and his head was like over the side, he was in a wheelchair, and there were like troubles coming down the side of his mouth. And it's almost that thing where you see someone physically disabled, and it's almost a thing thinking, well, maybe they're mentally as well. But when he spoke, you just knew this is Joe McDonald. And so everybody got a smoke. You were allowed to smoke in the prison hospital. You weren't allowed to smoke on the protest. And the makeup of the ICJP, the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace, was Dublin government appointees, Catholic Church, SDLP, so sort of not Republicans on the ground. And they were come to say that they had been in talks with the British government, and they had some, like, not only the basis of the five demands, but they were saying that even six demands. And the whole thing went on for 2 days, and it's always that thing where people talk about, you know, was there deals and all this. There never was a deal. There was always offers of what would be there if you were to end this, and that was never going to be enough for us, given the experience of the first one, and particularly given now that four people had already died in the meantime.
You're still tuned into The Conversation, your weekly alternative probe of political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. I'm joined by my co-host, Michelle Gildenew, alongside our special guest, Dr. Lawrence McKeown.
Martin Horson then died fairly suddenly and very painfully. And this is the thing, there are normally people died in different ways, but if you couldn't keep water down, and you're told to drink at least 6 pounds of water a day and take salt because you need it for your brain. But if you can't keep the water down, if you're being sick, then all these toxins in your body start to, the kidneys come under massive pressure. It happened to Paddy Quinn, it happened to Martin Harrison. So like for the last couple of hours of his life, he's thrashing about, hallucinating, and he's away in another world. And I learned, and later years after his release, and talking to Brendan, his brother, like Brendan was on one side of him holding him down, and the priest, Father Murphy, was on the other side holding him, so he wouldn't smash his face against the metal bed end. And then he did settle in for about an hour, and then he died. And really, when you're in the hospital, the irony was you're no longer a protesting prisoner, because you are in the hospital, you're wearing pyjamas, you're not refusing to wear the prison clothes. Around about 40-odd days, my eyesight started growing. I think that was the same for most people, and seeing double, but very clearly double. And then that changed into a more hazy, fuzzy sort of thing, and then it starts to be a light, start to annoy you, and be that like strip lighting, which is what anyway. But I suppose one of the main thing that we ended up noticing was that someone very close to death often had a bowel movement. And I remember always thinking that I'd read before about how if you're hung, your bowels open. And this was almost like in reverse, the body just letting go before it. And it happened till Tom McElwee. And I remember even Mickey Devine talking about it. And afterwards, it was a real drop in energy. You're ready, totally exhausted. But after that, usually nobody came out of their cell again in the ward, because there were cells, even though you're in a prison hospital. So it happened to Mickey Devine, and usually they're probably, what we'd reckon, you had 2 or 3 days after that, and then basically what happened. So when it happened to myself, I knew, and it's a very painful experience, and a very lengthy couple of hours, and literally just, I made it back till bed, I helped back till bed, and didn't get out of it after that. And then it was around that time that my parents were allowed in, families were allowed in, if you were seen to be at a critical stage, and they came in, my father, my mother, and sister and brother, all of them apart from my mother, asked me to come off the hunger strike, and I said I wasn't. And it wasn't because my mother was Republican, she wasn't. We just always had a... I mean, I don't recall any adult conversation with my mother, because I was on the run when I was at 17 and a half. Then I was in jail when I was 19. You only get an odd... You know, because other people were visiting, and you don't get much time to talk about it. Then we're on the protest. So never... had those type of adult conversations that we really have liked, you know, and both my parents that later died in jail, so never got to have them, but there was just always a very close bond. She just showed me unconditional love, and she wasn't going to ask me to do something that she knew was against me. That was the 68th day, and I remember them coming in. 69th, I don't really recall at all. Apparently I was responding to voices, but was getting confused, and I was just either sleep or starting to go unconscious a bit. And then on the 70th day, which was a Sunday, apparently the doctor goes around and checks all your reflexes and says, look, now you're in deep coma and you're not going to get any response. And what they had was power of attorney, which is that the prison weren't going to force feed us, but if your next of kin signed a document, the power of attorney shifted them and they could authorise medical intervention, which is what my mother did. And again, it was only in later years I thought back on it. What I do recall her saying to me on that 68th day was, and we were on our own, she had daughters gone out, and she says, you know what you have to do, and I know what I have to do. My mother's a very quiet person, and religious in the sense it was quiet faith, like she wouldn't have run religion down your throat. And an awful situation for families, and that had been brought on. I mean, that already been a number of people. I often wondered if I had been the first, would have looked on it differently, or if somebody had died after me, would have looked on it differently. But neither of those happened. And I said, my own mother died less than 2 years after it. So it's this awful thing that families were placed in that dilemma, and a big pressure on them from the Catholic Church, and particularly from Father Fall, that a good mother or a good wife would authorise medical intervention. Which by implication means that you're a bad wife or a bad mother if you don't. I regained consciousness in the intensive care unit of the Royal Victoria Hospital, just a few hundred yards down from here. And then the interesting too, thinking back,